driving in your car. Leave all the city behind. Up on the motorway, Scotland's not far. See what we can find. No time, no time to lose. No time, no time to lose. But more than my share of people give me advice, the way that my life it should be. Look at the country man, it's looking so nice, feeling so good to be free. Yeah. No time, no time to lose. No time, no time to lose. All right.
Thank you. make it last. Lay down your load, let it all pass. Roll, just roll till the day is done. Drifting through, just drifting through. Ah, we're all drifting through.
Play it, Billy Boy.
Thank you very much and welcome to the Kennedy Center in Washington. We are called Lindisfarne, which is the name of an English island off the northeast coast near Scotland, and that's where we live. And we're just over here taking your money at the moment. This is this is the end of the last concert on a two-week American tour, and it's really nice to be in Washington where there isn't any snow. Because everywhere we've been, Boston, Chicago, Cincinnati, everywhere we've been, has been snow. But Washington's great because it's really sunny today. We're going to continue with an instrumental, a tune that was written by Dave Denham here. We wrote this when we were recording up on the west coast of Scotland. In fact, the westerly most point of the British Isles was where we were. And we felt really close to you in America when we were there. The name of the place is Ardnamurchan, and that's the name of this tune, Ardnamurchan.
you.
Tried to buy them all in New York last night, but we said no. We're going to Washington tomorrow, and there's going to be a lot of disappointed people if we don't have some. So we'll save this for you. Yeah. The CD is called Here Comes the Neighborhood. It was recorded up in Scotland, and this is a song from it which describes the problems that two people falling out of love might have, where one of the people really tries hard to make everything go right, and the harder they try, the worse it gets. I hope none of you have ever been in that situation.
Like what we have.
This is called Can't Do Right for Doing Wrong.
I seem kind of blue to you. It's just 'cause I'm not getting through to you. And I'll do anything you want me to, just so we can get along. I should have a mind to say, what is it makes you want to be this way? Could be today's just not my lucky day. And I can't do right for doing wrong. I've told you what you mean to me. I've even told you what you mean to me. I wish we could be where we both belong, but I can't do right for doing wrong. I say too little or I say too much. I see no recognition in your eyes. I try to fix it with a tender touch, but I see too late, the chance has passed by. Sometimes when I don't have much time to stay, I'll make a move and watch you turn away. I'll hesitate, I should come on strong.
lay down some good tea with a power-driven soul. I had my share of nightmares, didn't think there could be much more. And in walked Roderick Usher with the Lady Eleanor. She tied my eyes to the ribbons of a silver ghostly thread. I gazed with troubled vision on an old four-poster bed, where Eleanor had risen to kiss the neck below my head and bid me come along with her to the land of the dancing dead. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. All right, Lady Eleanor. I'm all right where I am. She goes with a loving beauty like a mother to his son, like living, dying, seeing, being all rolled into one. Then all at once I heard some music in my bones, the same old song I heard for years, reminding me of home. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. And when it seemed for certain that the screams could get no higher, I heard a voice above the rest screaming, "You're a liar." But it's all right, Lady Eleanor.
A song by our old friend Alan Hull. Thank you very much for that.
Thanks.
Oh, marvelous water you have in this country. Wish I could say the same about the beer.
Only a joke, it's just a joke.
Being a non-drinking band, we don't know anything about that, of course.
All right, we're going to continue with another track from the Here Comes the Neighborhood album, which will probably shortly be in your possession. And this track is a song called Jubilee Corner, and Jubilee Corner exists in England, in quite a lot of places, and it's the place in town where people, usually young people who don't have very much to do, sit around and drink various concoctions of alcohol. We have an alcoholic cider over in England, and it really has a kick if you mix it up with white out or any old aftershave that you're not using. That's an interesting concoction. And these people just sit and watch the world go by. And I'm sure you've got places like that in the US. Not that we've seen any on our visit. This is called Jubilee Corner.
Thank you.
way down in the middle of town, right there on the corner of the street, just across from the Benetton billboard, that's where the angels meet. Down there on Jubilee Corner, yeah, they look you in the eye. Don't mean to scare anybody, just sit and watch the world go by. I'm going down to Jubilee Corner, see what it's all about. Going down to Jubilee Corner, yeah, and let it all hang out. Me a worn out raincoat, gonna get me a plastic bag, gonna get me a bottle of cider, yeah, I'm dressed all in white. Sometimes I sit there thinking, sometimes I'm just gonna sit, most times I sit there drinking, just see how far I can spit. Going down Jubilee Corner, see what it's all about. Going down to Jubilee Corner, yeah.
So you've been warned, don't ever go there.
Jubilee Corner.
Mm-hmm. Believe me, he knows what he's talking about.
Okay. We're going to do a song now about a wannabe rock and roll singer who eventually made it. Nice happy ending. This is called A Ghost in Blue Suede Shoes.
Morning. dressed and feeling fine. One look in the mirror says, not bad for 59. He's checked his reservation. He's got no time to lose. Today's the day he's off to find a ghost in blue suede shoes. He shuts the door behind him and feeling like a lord, he walks right past the cavalier and takes the V8 board. He's put his kids through college, he's worked, paid his dues, but now it's time to go and find a ghost in blue suede shoes. Those who still remember, they come from all around. Miles and years will disappear when they're dancing to that sound. Someone lights the fuse. For these few days, they're here to raise a ghost in blue suede.
Thank you very much. A long time ago, 60 years ago, over 1936, the northeast of England was hard hit by unemployment, and so hard hit that a group of men decided they needed to protest, and led by a man called Marshall Riley, they walked from Newcastle upon Tyne in the north of England to London, which is about 300 miles. To hand in a protest, and they were helped on the way only by what we call common people, who fed and clothed them and housed them on the way. And after their journey, they arrived in London only to find that nobody would take their protest, nobody would accept them, so all they had to do was turn around and come back again, and nothing changed. And we'd like to sing this song, which was written by Alan Ho in remembrance of those men. The song is called Marshall Riley's Army, and we're singing it because the situation still exists. Mm-hmm.
took a trip. The man who made the ships, searching for some kind of salvation. With head held high, dignified, the townsfolk and the passers-by held them in some kind of admiration. March on, Marshal Riley's army, marching for your rights, you surely earned them. March on, Marshal Riley's army, the lesson that you taught us, who has learned them? And the soldiers in the front line of the struggle for the right to work, did God give me these hands just to be idle? While His Holiness the Bishop with His infinite crystal wisdom, like Peter when the cock crew had denied them. March on, Marshal Riley's army, marching for your rights, you surely earned them. March on, Marshal Riley's army, lessons that you taught us who has still down there if you're working class. Can anybody tell me what is changed?
March on, Marshal Riley's army, marching for your rights, you surely earn them. March on, Marshal Riley's army, the lessons that your daughter who has learned them.
You're going to start a thing. I've taken the pledge. All right. We're going to do another song from our new album, from the Neighborhood album. This is a song which we'd like to dedicate to two people who help this band exist. One is Reinhard Grull, who lives in Dusseldorf in Germany. And the other is Pat Garrett, who lives in Tucson, Arizona. And those two men have helped this band enormously in the last few years, so we'd like to send this message to those two guys. Thanks very much indeed. And this song is a song which tries to describe the feelings of some people, attempts to live. Some people just think about things that they would like to do and never actually get round to doing them. And when it comes to years and years later, they look back and think, well, how come I never did anything? You know, I just sat and thought about it all the time. And this is a song about people who think about getting out of somewhere and never managed to do it. It's called One Day.
Took a walk downtown. I met a friend of mine sitting on the corner drinking wine. He had a look about him, cold, underfed. he said. One day I'll be out of this place, one step down the line. One day, cause it's never too late, things will turn out fine in a better place in time. One day. There's a girl I see sometimes, but in the days gone by, she never had that lost look in her eye. She never had that wedding ring. Now she knows the score. And if you ask her what she's looking for, this place, one step down the line.
tell me, have you dreams I can see? I came along just to bring you the sun. Can you spare one dream for me? You won't have met me and used to forget, so don't mind me tugging at your sleeve. I'm asking you if I can fix a rendezvous, for your dreams are all I believe. On the corner where the lights are coming on, and I'll be there. I'll be there. Down the end, these streets will disappear into the dark. Down the empty streets will disappear into the dawn. If you have dreamed enough to share. Hey, Mr. Dreamseller, where have you been? Tell me, have you dreams I can see? I came along just to bring you this song. Can you spare one dream for?
Still. goodbye past. The time is fine, the future's cursed. Poor old people, poor old planet, poor old universe.
Oh,
you very much. You've been watching Dave Denham on the red guitar. This is Billy Mitchell on the blue guitar. Ray Laidlaw on the drum set. Ian Thompson played the bass. Marty Craggs on the accordion and flute. And Rod Clements on slide guitar and mandolin. You've been very kind. Thanks very much for listening. It's, I'm sure you didn't have a clue what you were going to get when you walked in. But you stayed, so I guess some of you enjoyed it. If anyone does want to buy the CD, they're available at the back, and we'll be out as soon as the show's finished, and we'll sign them or tear them up or whatever you want us to do with them. Or we'll buy them back off you cheaper, you know, whatever it is. We've got to make the fare back to England somehow, and we've got to get back tomorrow. So anything you can do to help would be great. And we'll finish this this last concert on this USA tour with this song. And this is another one from the album. And I hope you all feel the same as we do about the title. It's called Born at the Right Time. Your man's hopes are dashed to hell. It's hard to earn a dime. They're kicking their heels and revving their wheels, searching for better times. Me, I'm kicking into my prime, 'cause I was born at the right time. Old man's thoughts are in the past, the future holds no store. Their lives are left in tatters, fighting someone else's war. I wasn't party to that crime, 'cause I was born at the right time. And now I'm living on the coastline. I got up from the breadline. Now I'm drinking the good wine. Go fishing in summertime. Sleep all day if I have a mind. 'Cause I was born at the right time. I was born at the right sage. While there are songs still to be sung, new words to grace the page, a better age I'll never find, 'cause I was born at the right time, and now I'm living on a coastline. I got up from the breadline, now I'm drinking the good wine. Go fishing in summertime, sleep all day if I have a mind, 'cause I was born at the right time. So I'm wishing that we'll all see better days. My secret feeling is I'm happy in my ways. And a smile comes on me thinking of the past. But I won't sigh for days gone by. Now is where I'm at. Thanks a lot, folks. Great to see you.
Just to start off, Ray, for yourself, how were you drawn to the drums as your instrument of choice?
Watching stuff on TV when I was little, I think. I never actually seen a drum kit in the flesh, if you like, till I got my first one. But I'd seen stuff on TV. There used to be a TV program called 6-5 Special, another one called Oh Boy,
yep.
That was on in the late 50s in Britain. And used to have people like Marty Wilde and Cliff Richard and films of Elvis and stuff. And I just loved the look of them. You know, like some blokes like motorbikes?
Yeah.
I just loved what drum kits looked like before I even thought about playing one.
So it was like love at first sight.
I don't know what it was. It was something to do with all the, you know, the shiny bits and, yeah. and the noise you could make.
What about your musical instruments and your musical interests and your musical roots? Were they related to the type of music that you would later play in Lindisfarne?
Not really. I mean, it was just the pop music of the day when I was little. When you know, but around about the same time as I'm telling you about that stuff, I used to a cousin of mine lived over the road. Well, two or three cousins, all girls. And this particular one was about 3 years older than me. So when I was about 11, she'd be what 14-ish, 15-ish, getting interested in boys. And I used to be used as the jiving partner when she practiced before she went to parties and dances.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched some TV with her, watching, you know, how they reacted to musicians and singers and stuff. And I think that's what got me interested, watching the teenage girls' reactions to when I watched it. I thought this is a good way to get myself in with the women.
Tell us about the formation of Lindisfarne. Did you have a formula for the sound that you wanted there?
Not so much a formula. We knew what we didn't like more than what we liked, you know? And when we were just a little local regional band, we always try to do things a bit different. So we took in interests and influences from stuff that we thought was different. So by the time we'd been going a few years, we were writing a few songs of our own, but we were also covering a lot of folk blues stuff, a lot of Chicago blues. So there's a lot of Muddy Waters, a lot of some bits of Woody Guthrie, but we're also like covering some Zappa songs and things like that, you know. So it was a bit left field.
It was rather diverse, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel lucky that the band came about it during the era that it did? How do you think a band like Lindisfarne would go trying to break through nowadays?
Oh, I think it'd be almost impossible. I mean, well, in some ways now, it's easier because people are more interested in acoustic music than they were then.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just got lumbered under the folk banner, which was instantly untrendy and hip in the late 60s, early 70s. But that was because we used acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
But I mean, so did the Beatles, you know. But nobody bothered about that. But the one benefit in those days was you had the time to develop, which is very different these days with young bands coming along. You know, the record companies these days, by and large, they expect success very quickly, and if they don't get it, you know, you're dumped.
Yeah.
We had the luxury of being able to develop in public, if you like.
Yep. A lot of the live recordings of the band really generate a good time feel, almost a party-like atmosphere. I gather that was important to you guys to maintain that fun element all the way through?
Well, again, it goes with the territory. I mean, quite a lot of the subject matter of our songs was quite serious, you know, with a serious message. When it comes to putting a gig on, we were aware that people came out for a night out and we were entertainers, so we wanted them to go home with a smile on their face.
Mm.
So we would never hide the fact that we enjoy playing live, and we would never try and stop the audience from getting involved. You know, if they wanted to jump up on the seats and dance and sing and join the choruses, well, that was fine by us. And I suppose there was a time when we sort of actively encouraged it.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, show me a band that doesn't, you know. Yeah. Unless you want to do the poor-faced approach, you know, and pretend that you were somewhere else. I mean, that was never us.
Yeah. When did the band really peak for you and become the band that you wanted it to be?
That's a very good question. I think we did it three times, actually. Well, there was the early days, you know, the very early 70s when we had the very big success, in, you know, nationally and internationally.
Yeah.
And then the band split for a bit, and we came back again in the late 70s when we had a bit more control of our own destiny, if you like. We were managing ourselves then and whatnot, and we came back with a Run for Home single and a big album, and that felt really good because we were sort of doing it on our terms then.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third time, after Alan Hoad died in 95, we decided to keep the band going regardless, and within about 3 years of sort of struggling a bit, to be honest with you, we'd put a couple of albums out, sort of like 99-ish and 2002-ish, which didn't sell huge amounts but got really good reviews and proved to us that there was still life after Alan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was sort of 3 ages of the band, if you like.
Yeah. There are pivotal moments in a band's lifespan, and one of those is always when you first hear one of your records on the radio. Do you remember that moment for you?
I remember it very well, yeah. We were driving somewhere, and we were all travelling in one little van with a gear in the back, you know, and we came on some radio program and we pulled into the side of the road and turned it up as loud as we could and jumped up and down. I remember it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, you get very blasé about that sort of stuff after a while, but the first time it happens is amazing.
Yeah, it's one you never forget. How did the recording deal, your original recording deal with Charisma, come about?
It was a bit convoluted. We'd done a few tests for various people, sent stuff off, but as is usually the case when you're a bit different, people don't know quite what to make of you. And we were sort of coming through with the main thing in British music when we were coming through was sort of like the first heavy metal boom, you know, with Deep Purple and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were obviously a million miles away from that, so people didn't know quite what to make of us. But what happened was, a band up here who had the same manager as us, one of their members went off to join a band called Jackson Heights, which was started by a guy called Lee Jackson, who had been in the Nice, a band called the Nice Progressive Band.
Yep.
And never want to sort of, you know, pass up an opportunity, our manager went up to London to talk to the record company to see if he could get some sort of compensation because he'd lost his guitar player for his band. And while he was there, he took down some tapes of us. And I think really to fob him off more than anything else, Tony Stratton-Smith said, well, you know, I quite like the sound of them. I'll give them a gig at the Marquee, because they had the Marquee Club in London. He had a weekly night, Charisma Night. So we went down and supported somebody a fortnight later, and he really liked it. And he offered us a deal. But around about the same time, we'd actually we did an audition for George Martin's company.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Abbey Road and did something, and they offered us a deal at the same time. So, but we liked the Charisma setup, so we went with them.
Now, you mentioned earlier the chart hits that you had in those early days, and the songs such as Meet Me on the Corner and Lady Eleanor. Were you prepared for that kind of success?
I think we were sort of prepared for the success, but not what came with it. I mean, we always had a sort of arrogance. I mean, we knew we were good. I mean, first of all, we knew we were the best band in, you know, in Tynemouth, our little town. Then we knew we were the best band in Newcastle, and then we thought we were the best band in the Northeast. And then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it went on like that. So we had this sort of, because we were gigging around a lot and seeing lots of other people and supporting just about anybody that came to the Northeast of England. We would get the support slot. So we saw these bands, you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them were good, but a lot of them weren't that good. And we always felt that we had something really original. The more things you saw, the more perspective you got on the whole scene. So we gradually realized how good we were and didn't have that much, there wasn't that much surprise when we started getting successful. But then when the record started happening, suddenly that catapults you into another sort of world altogether. And, you know, when Frog in the Time was at its peak, because that was a huge selling record in this country.
Yeah.
It was the second biggest selling album of the year, you know, it's only Bridge Over Troubled Water sold more. We were suddenly put into this position where everybody knew us, not just people who bought the records, that, you know, we'd see on Top of the Pops and everybody really knew you, you know? And it was a bit weird. And we didn't sit comfortably with that, because we always have, you know, our heroes were Dylan and the band and Leonard Cohen and, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing we wanted to do. We didn't want to be T-Rex.
Were those songs recorded with hit single success in mind, or did that surprise you when that came?
Well, we knew they were catchy songs. We knew people, you know, I don't think at the time any of our songs at the time were longer than 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, we were sort of, making records in the style that the Beatles had 5 years earlier, in terms of, you know, catchy songs would say something and get a hold of you quick. That was what we liked. I mean, some of the songs were a bit longer than that, but at least half of what we did was fairly instant, you know. So we weren't that surprised. When we finished the first album, the Nicely Out of Tune album, we had like four or five choices for the first single, and I think, I mean, it's been joked about before, but I think the five songs were put in a bag and we pulled one out. You know, and that's what Clear Our Light was, the first release.
Yeah. When the band split in two that first time, and some of you went on to form Jack the Ladner, what was it that triggered that off?
Well, really, it was because of the huge success of Fog on the Tyne. When the next album came around, because we were managed by the record company, you see, that we were a bit naive. We didn't understand what was going on. We were the only band making money at the time for the label. And obviously they were very keen to get another album out as quick as they could so they could, you know, fund their other things. And we were pushing to making it too quickly. And also we weren't actually prepared for the fact that whatever we did after Fog on the Tyne was going to appear to be a failure, because you couldn't get that successful again.
Mm-hmm.
It was highly unlikely, you know, because the album was number one for 12 weeks and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So we started, Alan was uncomfortable about the amount of this time we had to make a record, and he was feeling a bit uncomfortable about living in London, and he was cut off from his inspirations, if you like. Some of the rest of us in the band, me, I was one of them. I wanted to tour more because I thought that was the answer. But I was single at the time, you know, no hang-ups. Anyway, cut a long story short, we agreed to disagree and thought, well, let's just knock it on the head and start again. So we split into two. You know? And originally, Alan was going to do his own thing, because he had his Pipe Dream solo album was out by then, and he was going to have his own band and do it his own way, but the record company didn't want to lose the main chance, so they talked him into reforming another version of Lindisfarne, which he did.
Did you remain a fan of what the guys in the new Lindisfarne were doing?
I did, personally. I mean, I used to go and see them. They used to come see us. I mean, there was a big, you know, lots of people reckon we never spoke, but, you know, I think we were upset with each other for about a fortnight,
yeah,
you know, because of the way things happened. And then it was back to normal because we had the same circle of friends, so you couldn't avoid each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And we started turning up at each other's gigs and all the rest of it. And obviously there was a bit of healthy competition between us, but nothing more than that. And I used to go and see them, yeah, and I really liked what they did, but I think they made a mistake by calling the band what they did. You know, if it had been Alan Hull's Pipe Dream, they would have had a lot more success because they wouldn't have had to try and, you know, they weren't the right sort of players to play that, what we'd done.
Yeah,
before.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're a bit more sophisticated players than we were.
What was the initial plan for Jack the Lad? What did you want to do there differently to what you'd done with Lindisfarne?
We just wanted to get out there and be like the spirit of the original Lindisfarne. Everybody pitch the songs in, get out there and gig, you know. And I, you know, I still think the first Jack the Lad album was really, really good. I occasionally play it, but there's some good songs on there. In fact, it's interesting, if you look at the first Lindisfarne Mark II album and the Jack the Lad album and Pipe Dream, and if you take the best songs, the fourth Lindisfarne album would have been a belter, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
if those songs had ended up being on Lindisfarne number four. But there you go. Yeah. I mean, you know, when all that happened, I mean, Genesis were on our label as well, early days.
That's
and they
right.
watched what happened to us. And they were up to their, I think, their fifth or sixth album, and they still haven't made any money. They were in this huge financial hole. And they saw what happened to us, and they hired a big deal American music lawyer and marched into the office about a month after we'd split and said, right, we want a year off, we want this much money, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, either that or forget it, we're off, you know? And they got exactly what they'd asked for, but we were a bit naive and didn't realise we could have done that, you know?
There's definitely, I guess, a more traditional feel to the music of Jack the Lad, though, compared to Lindisfarne. Was that something you felt a need to do, to get back to the roots, so to speak?
Yeah, we did. We did it. We felt we needed just a bit of a direction because the first album, good as it was a bit disparate. It was a bit like a sampler. You know, there were songs in all different sort of styles. And we had been getting a bit more into some of the rootsy music from up here. Sort of second hand, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, our upbringing was rock and roll music, you know, Elvis, Buddy Holly, and then through that to the Beatles and Dylan and Tamamoto, all that stuff. And so the roots music of our own area, we got into sort of second hand way when you know, we suddenly found out that some of Dylan's songs were based on melodies of songs from the, you know, from Scotland and stuff, and went back around that way. So that was a conscious thing. Yeah, we deliberately did that just to as a project, really, you know, just to sort of give the band some, you know, a project aim at, really.
Yeah. And then when you all got back together again under the Lindisfarne banner later on in the 70s, was there anything you vowed to do differently that time around? You mentioned earlier you had greater control. Was that one thing that you really...
Yeah, that was the most important thing, yeah. We hired a manager, but he did what we wanted him to do, you know what I mean? We basically had meetings and everything was discussed, everybody was involved, we formed our own company. It was a bit scary at the time, you know, but it seemed like we were a little bit... big for our boots, I suppose, in some ways, but we soon got comfortable with it and realized that it gives a lot more autonomy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And did it that way. I'm glad we did, because, I mean, you know, there was a barren patch through the 80s when we didn't sell many records, but because we had our touring hat on and it was all so slick and all so well put together in terms of the mechanics of it, we managed to make a reasonable living just gigging.
Do you think in hindsight that break was something you had to have to have the band go on for as long as it did in the end?
Yeah, I think we did. I think if we'd kept going at the original incarnation, I think we probably would have done very well and probably made a lot of money for a couple of years. We probably wouldn't have spoken to each other again after that, you know.
So in a way, it was probably a blessing in disguise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got no regrets about anything that happened to the band over the years. You know, I think everything has a reason. And we also, like you say, you react to things, don't you? And you respond to things and it makes you stronger.
Mm-hmm. During the 80s and 90s, there were quite a few lineup changes that shuffled around quite a bit, but you still ploughed on regardless. It wasn't unsettling at any stage?
No, because what happened was, you see, it was whenever we've never auditioned anyone ever in the band. All the years the band was going, there was never an audition. If somebody decided that they wanted to do something else for whatever reason, there was always somebody in our circle of friends, in our close circle of musical mates, that was right for the job. You know, that thought would be interesting as well. You know, like for instance, when Rod Clements was, he always played guitar on his own songs on when we recorded them, but he was the bass player in the band on stage. And we had a little part-time band we used to have some fun with when Lindisfarne wasn't touring, and Rod played slide guitar in that, and he was a great slide player. And we thought, you know, why not bring this element into Lindisfarne? So we needed a bass player. Well, there was a guy, a really good lad we used to play with locally, and some other things, and perfect, you know, a lovely player, lovely personality, just slid straight in there, big Stevie Cunningham, you know, without a problem, and there was always someone like that. So it didn't seem, we took those things on as positives, you know.
Mm. Now, of course, Alan Hull's passing would have been obviously a great blow to the band. Were there thoughts at that stage to just put the band to bed?
Yeah, but not for long. I mean, we actually convened a sort of like an emergency meeting the day after he died. A bit, you know, when you have that sort of bereavement, you need to gather together, you know, families do it, and we just got together at Rob's house and sat. Well, I think we were in a state of shock, to be honest with you. And we decided more or less immediately that we wanted to keep going, because we thought, well, what would be the point of stopping? I mean, albeit it was an experimental thing, because we didn't know how the audiences would take to us, you know, we didn't know if they'd accept it.
Mm.
But we decided to have a go, because we thought, well, we've got all this fantastic material. This is what we do. We're players. You know, what's the point in going off and forming new bands when we've got one that works?
Yeah.
You know, all we need to do is to draft somebody in to stand in that part, place, and sing those songs. You know, sing that part of the harmony. And we knew exactly who it would be, because he was going to be in the band once before, you know?
Yeah.
So, and the first year or so, it was, I think we were a bit shell-shocked and a bit tentative, and people were coming along to the gigs, really, just to see what would happen. I mean, some people I know I've spoken to, they never came to see us again when Alan died. They just couldn't do it. They couldn't face it. But a lot of people came along sort of quite with an open mind, you know, and then went away happy, you know, and thought, oh, right, well, you know, it's another twist in the tale, you know, we'll see what happens next. And I think about after about 2 years of basically just playing existing material, we thought, well, you know, let's dip our toe in the water. So we went off to Scotland and recorded a little 4 or 5 track EP, and liked the way it sounded, and liked the, you know, and put that out and got good reactions. So then we went, right, let's start writing for an album, you know, and it was good. It was interesting, and it was never to try, you know, we could never equal Holly's input.
Yeah,
you know, Alan was such an incredible writer and an incredible person. You know, we didn't try to replace him, we didn't try to compete with him. We just thought, you know, we've got talent within the band now as it exists, so let's do the best we can with what we've got.
I believe there's a special tribute night to Alan coming up soon.
Yeah, yes, that's it's almost 10 years to the day, anniversary of his death. It's on the 19th of November at Newcastle City Hall, which it couldn't be anywhere else.
Of course.
And just about everyone who's ever been in the band is coming back for that one night, and we're doing probably going to be about a 3.5 hour show, I would have thought. And we've got about 3 or 4 different bands and different people singing different songs, and some actor friends of ours and some other musicians and people who've, you know, people that Alan managed, and, you know, the whole shooting match, really.
Fantastic.
And we're going to record and video the whole thing.
Ah, tremendous. It's talking about special gigs. Obviously, the final gig in 2003 must have been a magic night too.
It was a great night. But I mean, it was a bit of an emergency stop, if you know what I mean. I mean, we only decided that it was going to be the last gig about 2.5 weeks before it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we decided in mid-tour, you know, we'd been things happening, you know. You get to a point in a band where, you know, a band is a sort of a gang, you know, and it's a young man's thing in lots of ways. And by now, Rod Clements had become the main writer and was doing a very good job of it, but he was also wanting to do his own thing. He'd always had this romantic notion of, you know, him with a guitar over his back, you know, of doing what he, turning around, playing where he ended up, and which is what he's doing now, and he's loving it. And I think he felt too much responsibility having to provide material for the band and also to be able to do his own thing. And he said he was considering knocking it on the head. And then a couple of other things happened, which sort of brought things to a head. So we sat down one night after a show and said, right, okay, it's obviously not nobody's heart's really in it anymore, you know. We've done it and we've done really well. Let's not compromise, so let's knock it on the head at the end of the tour. So that's what we did. So we hastily got together the recording and you know, the film unit and everything, and drafted in about 40 minutes worth of tunes on top of what the 2 hours we were doing, and recorded the whole thing. And it was highly charged emotional evening. But I'm glad we did that. I'm glad we didn't decide to pack in and then, you know, do a farewell show 3 months later or something like that.
Yeah.
It would have been strange.
Yeah. Now, away from music, you've had some involvement in production with film and television, is that right?
Yeah, I'm doing that now, yeah. I've been doing that for about 5 years now. 5 or 6 years. In the past, whenever Lindisfarne have had a TV thing to do, whether it was a promo for one song or a special or a documentary or whatever, it was always me that was sort of the band's representative, if you like. A, because they couldn't be bothered, and B, because I was interested.
Yeah.
And so in actual fact, there were quite a few of the things we did I produced early on, although I didn't actually get that title and didn't realise that's what I was doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was just making it happen and, you know, liaising with the production company or whatever it may be. And I've got a very good friend, a guy called Jeff Wanfor, who did all of the early Lindisfarne stuff. He's the same age as me. And me and him used to sit up all night in the BBC in Newcastle, cutting films together, you know, that we'd done that day, and making sure that, so they went out on the next day's news programmes, that sort of stuff. And he asked me to get involved with him about the year 1999, 2000, to get involved with him in a couple of things, and it just mushroomed from there. So I'm working with him more or less full time now.
Fantastic.
Pardon?
Working on any particular projects at the moment?
We've got a couple of nice ideas. Well, they're not our ideas necessarily. I mean, sometimes we get asked to come in and do something. We do regional things and national things. I mean, the biggest thing we've done nationally, internationally, we did a biography, a TV biography of Stella McCartney.
Oh, yeah.
And we've been working recently. We'd worked on the Live 8 thing. We worked on Band 8 2, Band 8 20. We did the documentaries about that.
Uh-huh.
We've done a couple of... Do you know who Jules Holland is down there?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how popular he is. Well, we did one of his live shows at the Royal Albert Hall recently.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a couple of natural history things. We've done all sorts of stuff. And the thing we've just done most recently, there's a thing up here called the Tall Ships Race that happens every 10 or 15 years. Sailing ships do this race around Europe and Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big... And they basically have 3 or 4 ports to come into for 4 or 5 days. Well, this huge flotilla of over 100 ships come into Tyneside for a week, and we've made a film about that, which was a really exciting thing to do, and that's just come out on DVD locally. So we don't just do, you know, network stuff, we do
yeah.
whatever takes our fancy and people want us pays to do.
So that's your main focus now? You think your days as a touring musician are pretty much over?
I do bits and pieces. I mean, we did something the other day. Are you aware who Paul Gascoigne is?
You're going to have to prompt me there. The name rings a bell.
Gazza. Well, he's a football player. He played for England and he's a soccer player. You know?
Okay, yep.
Well, there's a big charitable organisation in Britain called the Variety Club of Great Britain, which is a showbiz charity, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And the Northern region occasionally put these tribute lunches on. I had one for Sting in the summer and they've had them for actors and whatever, you know. Anyway, they had one for Paul Gascoigne on Friday and half a dozen of us who used to be in the band got together first for the day because we were his favourite band and did four or five songs at the event. So I was playing on Friday, which was really good fun.
Fantastic.
And I'll be doing the you know, Alan's tribute thing and that'll be good fun. But I can't see myself being a full-time player again.
No.
Drum kits are getting too heavy.
And just to finish up, Ray, how would you like to see Lindisfarne remembered?
Oh, I don't know. We're all things to all men. I mean, I think as a songwriting band, I think basically, you know, I think the strength of the band was in the songwriting and in our relationship with our audience. I once heard a thing Bruce Springsteen said, right, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, and I wish I'd thought of it. Somebody asked him at the end of a gig, this is years ago, and he'd been on the stage for about 3.5 hours, you know, so why do you do it? You know, most bands do an hour, you know, why do you put so much into it? And he says, well, it's simple. He said, every gig I do, there's going to be somebody seeing me for the first time and somebody seeing me for the last time, and mm-hmm. I want them to get the best. And I think in our own small way, we try to do that as well. We always try to give people quality, always try to give them value for money, always try to send them home, you know, with lots of good ideas in their head. And that's basically what it was about for us.
Fantastic. Ray, thanks so much for your time. It's been a treat to catch up with you.
Well, you're more than welcome. It's a privilege, actually, to think that people down there still know about us. We had some good times down there.
Yeah, I know. You've never forgotten, that's for sure.
Smashing.
Congratulations on a great career with one of England's most loved bands. And good luck with the tribute night coming up shortly. We'll look out for the CD and DVD release of those.
Thank you very much.
All the best, Ray.
Yeah, cheers, man.
Take care. Bye-bye.